was a small wood reverie.
Plastic explosive, which burnt extremely well, and there were a lot of grenades, and they exploded extremely well too. Ammunition was going off in every direction, like a firework display, at which moment an American in a tank arrived down the road, and I jumped up to him. He said, "Say, what are you doing here?" So I said, "Well, I was a Limey officer." And he said, "Well, God." He said, "But," he said, "I can see two people down there in German uniform. Shouldn't I be killing them?" So I said, "No, they're friends of mine." So he said, "I'm going to tell my grandchildren about meeting you." So I can't remember how, we went back to Avignon for dinner. It was very good. Put our people into hospital. That was probably the more exciting moment. Going back to Apt, this attack on Apt, there is a very romanticized story by Bing Crosby in his book about it, which is very far from the truth, I regret to say.
What are the inaccuracies?
Yes. He explains how he took charge and did this, that, and the other, and what happened, and so on. But considering I got in touch with him, not him with me, to try and coordinate this thing, no mention about anything else except himself. Not that it matters, but it was it. A little later on, with my driver, I was reconnoitering with my Russian bodyguard, Ivan Gualoub, lying on the wing of my Citroën with his machine gun in his hand. And we went 30 kilometers, past the American lines, and there was nothing. So when I went back to the Americans, I said, there's nothing there. And nobody was a bit interested, so I went to our divisional headquarters, the 3rd Infantry Division, General O'Donnell commanding, and I said, "I think you ought to know there's nothing in front of you." And they woke the general up, and he said, "Say, what's all this about?" And he said, "G3, go with this Limey captain and see what's going on." So we drove through the American lines, and this fellow, captain, was not used to being unsupported by the army. He was not in the best of moral states at the time, but we drove 30 kilometers north and turned around and came back, and so they moved the whole division forward. Would you be interested to know about my Russian?
Please.
Well, Ivan Golub, born in 1917, Novosibirsk, Black Earth Country, Russia, a tractor driver. He was a lieutenant in the Russian army and could not command more than 40 men in battle because he had not got a university education. As I've already said, I picked him up by the side of the road, and he became a good friend and a most loyal man. He used to sleep outside, curled up outside the door of my bedroom to protect me at night. His history was that he had been in Ukraine and bypassed by the Germans, joined the partisans. Regarded all Ukrainians as traitors. And he said the Germans started shooting. He said, "I don't know why." He said they stopped after a while, and they said they put him in a prisoner of war camp, surrounded him with barbed wire, gave him no food or drink, any of them, for 30 days, came in every day and hit them with the butts of their rifles, said, "You are a volunteer for General Vlasov's army, aren't you?" He said, "On the 30th day, I decided I was." You know who General Vlasov was?
Indeed.
The Russian general went over. So I joined them. And then after a while, the Germans didn't think much to us, so I was then put into a factory to make uniforms, and I did that. Then transferred to the Tote organization, and he was working on the southern defenses. And then, as I said, he escaped. He just drove it into a tree and ran. I saved him from killing himself, which was very slob of him. But we were having far too much to drink one evening, and he'd been sleeping with an attractive French resistance girl who changed her mind and gone off with somebody else. And he was in his most slav mood of gloom, and he was saying, tomorrow, no more Ian. I said, Ivan. I said, why? He said, well, I can't shoot myself. Why? Well, he explained me, and I said, well, seemed rather a silly thing to do, but I was drunk as he was, probably drunker, I don't know. So I said to him, right. I said, well, before you should kill yourself, let's have one last drink together. So I had a morphia tubonic thing stuck in, and I put that into the glass. I put three tablets of morphine into it, stirred it up, poured the wine in, and said, bottoms up. And he went out. And I went to bed, imagining that perhaps he was alive or perhaps he was dead, but I didn't think it made a lot of difference. He's going to kill himself. And in the morning he came to, and he found this sort of deposit in the glass. He said to me, Tavarish Kapitan, mauvais camarade. And I said, well, he said, yes, but he said, you shouldn't have done it. I should have shot myself, and I'm not going to. And he held it against me that I'd stopped him killing him, but quite in a friendly way. I took him up to Paris with me, and I handed him over to a friend of mine. He went off to the German enclave at Royan, and he got a Legion of Honor there. And I'd arranged for him to have false papers, because I knew that the Russians would shoot him if they... And I'd arranged all this, and he said to me, I am going back to Russia. And I said, you're not, you know, you're foolish. And so he went over eventually to the zonal border in Germany, received with bands playing and so on. And after the bands played Welcome Back to the Motherland, they took them out around the corner and started shooting them. It became dark and they hadn't shot the ball, so they put them on one side in prison, ready to be shot next day. And he killed a guard, escaped, went to Paris, where I believe he was pimping for a while. From there he went to as a coal miner in Belgium. We had used to have letters from him through Louis Malat and Avignon, so I know about his history. I think he's dead now. But he was a most interesting man, but he was very, very patriotic. And I told him he'd be shot if he went back to the Germans, but to the Russians. He didn't believe it. Oh, they don't do that sort of thing in my country. I said, they bloody do.
Strange that you knew more about Russia than he did.
Well, he was indoctrinated and born 2 years younger than I was. His mother's called Agafia. I've never forgotten. I had beautiful false documents done for him to cover him, but I still told him not to go back. I then met, yes, another story down there. I met this man too secret to be seen that I mentioned earlier. He was in for FSU recovering us. And he came to me one day and he said, just in the best Hollywood manner, he said, we have a vital message we've got through the German lines. Only you can do it. And here's a BSA motorcycle, go and deliver this message. So Louis Malat and I went, he came up with pillions. We went along, and after a while he said to me, you don't drive this very well, do you? I said, no. He said, well, I've never driven anything more than 50 cubic centimetres, power-assisted bike. I think I can do better than you. So without any great difficulty, he just rang up and we went through the German lines and came to Colonel de Saint-Sauveur, who I mentioned earlier. I think it was an invitation to dinner, but it wasn't. We sat there, and we gave this message over, and then we watched a battle developing. It's the first time I've ever seen a fight actually start like that. This is what happened. There were eight Germans in a rear guard in a trench, and the Americans came up, and infantry met them. Well, they shot them up a bit, and then they brought up the company, infantry company. They then brought up regimental headquarters. They then brought up a battery of guns. And then they brought up the general. And we were standing in the field watching all this, you know, sort of as in a theatre. Unfortunately, one of the Germans loosed off a 40-millimeter mortar shell into the field we were in. And so we ran very, very quickly into a ditch. And the Colonel de Saint-Sauveur's sky blue képi was in the middle of the field. And there was a young resistance aspirant with me, and we both looked at the Colonel, looked at each other. We both got out and ran to get it. Well, I ran faster than he did, so I got there. And Colonel Saint-Sauveur acknowledged it later at the dinner, how his hat had been saved in battle. Anyhow, after all this had happened, the place was littered with shell cases and so on, and they'd been there about 2 or 3 hours. They eventually killed all the Germans, and that was it, and they went on. It was the most extraordinary sight.
Why did they make such a meal of...
Well, they did. The Americans did. The Americans didn't give a sod about anything. I mean, they would fire... I mean, they're going forward. They would just open up with everything. You couldn't see anything. Civilians, whatever it was, didn't matter, just firepower. The only thing they didn't call in on this was an air attack, you know, but I wasn't very impressed. Nor was Colonel Saint-Sauveur very impressed with it. I shouldn't be rude about our American allies, but it was an interesting experience to see these eight very brave Germans holding up the American advance.
Where was this?
God, I'm trying to remember. I do know, but I'd have to look it up on a map somewhere.
Was it before or after Orange?
Oh, no, this is after Orange. Yes, it was... I think it was Apt, Orange, and then this... somewhere or other, I probably have a note about it, but I'd have to... I don't know.
Don't worry.
No, it's only a little... silly story.
But it was August 1941.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it might even be in September. I was there about a fortnight. We did miss about a bit and go and have fun and look at things and jump about a bit. We didn't just sit there, even though the Americans were there. I had the immense pleasure of liberating Toulouse, which, not that I'd had anything to do with it, the Germans were all gone, but I was kissed by everybody. It was great fun. No danger whatever.
You were the first Allied soldier into Toulouse?
Yes. We received... we went straight into a hotel, which was being the Gestapo headquarters, and used all the drink for free. Reserve pour la Wehrmacht, which they left behind, all the champagne, and it was great fun.
Toulouse seems to be a bit further west than some of the...
Well, I know, exactly. But look, I also went down to Andorra.
In the Pyrenees?
Yes, I went to Andorra. I thought it'd be fun to go down there, so I went down to Andorra and had trouble with the... Spanish Republicans on the border, because they maintained I was a German. You know, they didn't know who I was. They didn't like me at all. But they did let me in the end, I explained myself. They thought I was an escaped German officer going down there. Because being a sensible fellow, you see, I had parachuted into France in Sam Brown and a service dress and everything properly dressed. On the basis, I did all my training jumps and service dress on the basis, if I'm going to die, I might as well die properly dressed. And I went all along the coast. I did a lot of travelling about, looking at things and poking at things, seeing things and having a little fun. Anyhow, that's my Russian volunteer, I said, I think I'm going to Burma next. And he said, well, I'll come too. And I said, no, you can't. No. If I'd been a rich landowner, I'd have taken him and had him back in England. Because he was a wonderful fellow. Very tough. Very, very tough indeed. Very Russian.
His name was Golub.
Ivan Golub, G-A-U-L-O-U-B.
So, how did you get your appointment to go to Burma, please?
Well, we got back to England, and I'd made it my business to get to go and get some Pouillé fumé, a dozen bottles of Pouillé fumé on the way up to Paris, which I was able to bring back to England. But the man who sold it to me said, right, he said, you can have as much wine as you like. I said, right. He said, where are your bottles? I said, well, I haven't got any bottles. So he eventually found a few bottles, because there weren't any bottles. And then he said to me, now I want a dozen corks. Obviously I hadn't gotten any, and eventually he found some. I took this wine up with me to Paris, and I eventually got it back to England. We had a few agreeable days in Paris at the Lido, where all the acts had been recently performing for the benefit of the German officers. It was quite amusing. And I met an acrobatic dancer at the Lido. Anyhow, we went back to England, and it was rather fun arriving, the customs saying, we know you come from somewhere. We're not allowed to ask from where or ask you any questions, but you have to pass through customs. So I passed through customs with my wine. And I can't quite remember how, but somebody obviously asked and said, would you like to go to Burma? I think it was probably in Paris. And I thought, well, why not? So we went out on convoy, which was opposite Marseille when the German breakthrough happened. We had hoped we might be stopped and sent back to go on operating. However, we were not. And I passed a very depressing Christmas day in the Red Sea with half a bottle of beer and M&V for lunch, for Christmas lunch.
Who were you with on this voyage?
Well, it was a troop ship. I mean, the MV Batory, the Polish cruise liner, the MV Batory, Batory. We were in a big convoy. When I arrived in Bombay, I looked over the side, and there was my father, who'd come down to meet me. He'd had a guess that I might be on the convoy. And he went, and he, the first craft thing he saw was me leaning over the side. So OC troops said that I could disembark. I went off first before anybody else disembarked. I stayed with Admiral Rattray, commander of the Royal Indian Navy, who'd been my father's observer in the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War. And then I flew by Catalina, up to my father's commanding the base, RAF base at Karachi. And I then went from there to New Delhi, and then I flew down eventually down to Ceylon, where we did our training. And I arrived rather earlier than anybody would on the boat, very comfortably. We did our training there, and by the time I joined up with a chap called Ronnie Sherne, Captain Ronnie Sherne, an absolutely splendid sergeant called Sergeant Harrison, and made a team. We went and trained, and we found an aircraft crashed, which we reported. Nobody known where it was in the jungle. And Ronnie Sherne was a practicing Catholic. I was brought up a Catholic. It was rather interesting going to a little village, scarlet floor, so everybody could spit their Beetlejuice on, and having a local Sinhalese priest saying the Mass. When he was preaching in Sinhalese, I didn't understand, but I could follow it. We then went up to, after quite a lot of training there, it was very good actually, we went up to Calcutta, where I went up earlier, to do a landing course, making out of landing places. And we flew in 28th of February, 45, via Cox's Bazar and Calcutta, Cox's Bazaar, and then we went on into Kentung Province, China, Kentung Province, Burma, Southern Shan States, where I dropped into this very good friend of mine, Johnny Shaw, who I mentioned earlier, Royal Ulster Rifles, who had asked me to go in. He was already in the field. He'd been dropped blind with one wireless operator and produced a dropping zone. It was a very peculiar feeling because it was a very, very narrow valley, and when you looked out of the aircraft, you could see the roots of trees at eye level, which is a terrifying thing when you think about it. Anyhow, when after we'd landed, my sergeant said to me, "You know, sir," he'd already been in France, "I'd never have jumped, hadn't been your splendid example." I said, "You know how fucking frightened I was, you'd never, ever have followed me." But it was all very nice. And Ronnie Sherne, unfortunately, landed up in a tree, and the red ants came down, swarmed down his shroud lines, and swarmed down over the most tender parts of his person. And there he was, jumping about like a marionette, poor fellow. Anyhow, we recovered him from there. What was so nice, of course, because I read other people's report, was the relationship between Harrison and Johnny and myself. You know, we had this, and Ronnie, there were no problems whatever, which is great. I've read, I say, quite often about terrible people not getting on and so on, but we produced eventually, we had 900 men under arms, quite well trained, all in uniform, and about 300 were home guard. We just issued arms round. And though it was forbidden, Johnny Shaw, being a sensible fellow, absolutely insisted on keeping arms registers, because at the end of the war, apart from two rifles, we knew where they were with headmen, but a long way, so quite many days march away, we handed over to the British resident every single weapon. And you know all the troubles that have happened since and during them. But we weren't supposed to, but a lot of people, you know, didn't bother, but he was very meticulous about it. He'd served on the northwest frontier, been in Albania, and this was his second Burmese mission. I think, talking in the most general of terms about things that happened there, Ronnie Sherrin unfortunately was killed. The day the atomic bomb was dropped, we'd been promised reinforcement of 10 British officers. We were going to take the war to the Japanese in a big way. Before that, it had only been patrol. We had driven in their patrols. We were very much military ascendant in the area. They'd concentrated around Kentung, the capital. But we'd driven in all their outposts. We'd killed about six. There were also the Thais that were there. The Thai infantry division was there. One of the very few people who's ever killed Thais. They're supposed to be our friends.
How did that happen?
Well, they were an occupation. They'd been taken over by the Kingdom of Thailand. They'd annexed the place, and they were allies of the Japanese. And though I expect you know that we had a brigadier living with the British brigadier living with the Thai regent during the occupation. Did you know that? I expect you did.
No.
Yes, they're in constant touch. I say, there's a British brigadier in the Japanese occupation. But they were, as far as I was concerned, they were enemies of mine, and we killed them. And they killed Ronnie, but he was only 20.
How did it happen? Did you find out?
Ronnie Sherne died of wounds, leading a patrol some 10 days' march from our headquarters. We moved headquarters several times, and we took over what you might call large villages, circles, Mong Ping and places like that, and we drove in the Japs and the Thais into Kentung. We had expected to carry the war through in a very big way, because we had big reinforcements coming in of British officers. As there were only two British officers there, it was difficult to keep control without further influx of people. The war over, I re-established the frontier post at Tarkilek, which is the Golden Triangle for morphine, for opium. Rebuilt a house looking over a hill. Cut down the largest palm tree I could find and flew the largest, a very large Union flag. And we watched the Siamese and the Japanese pull out. We were told not to have anything to do. They were going to concentrate in northern Siam and surrender there. So my 70 Lahus and myself, we lined the ditches there and watched them out under the red white flag. But the Japanese were covering us with machine guns all the way. They were very windy indeed. They were going out on elephants and everything. It was the most amazing sight.
Your 70 what, did you say?
Lahus. Muso. Muso, Lahu, they're a hill tribe. See, we raised the hill tribes against the Japanese. We finished, I think it's about over a thousand men we had. And we'd done a lot of patrol work and shooting up people and so on, and I'd been blowing up lorries on the road. There was a strategic road that ran through there. But I say the real thing was we were very upset the war was over, because we're just getting into our stride. Now, the Royal Air Force was absolutely miraculous. From the point of view of supply, they were super, they really were. We'd been warned that we wouldn't get supply during the monsoon. And we thought, well, we live on the country, which we did. But they did go on flying right through the monsoon, and they came in and they took endless trouble dropping in, made several circuits, and very low drops and everything. They sent us papers, trucked in the thing. They were absolutely great. Highest possible respect for them. How they flew through those monsoon weather, and of course they lost a lot of aircraft in doing it, and they also had quite a lot of LMF, which I hadn't realized, a lack of moral fiber. Pilots wouldn't fly at all.
What did you think of the attitude of the Burmese hill people you armed against the Japanese?
Well, you must remember that it was a very primitive area, ruled by a Sorbar prince,